Chapter 2. Problems of Modern Psychotherapy. Psychotherapy, or the treatment of the mind by psychological methods, is identified in popular thought today with psychoanalysis. This word is now so widely accepted that everyone who uses it seems at the same time to grasp its meaning, yet it is seldom that a layman knows precisely what it covers. According to the intention of its creator, Freud, it can be appropriately applied only to his own particular method of explaining psychic symptoms in terms of certain repressed impulses. Inasmuch as this technique is the consequence of a particular approach to life, the ideas of psychoanalysis includes certain theoretical assumptions, among them the Freudian theory of sexuality. The founder of psychoanalysis himself explicitly insists upon this circumscription. But, Freud notwithstanding, the layman applies the concept of psychoanalysis to every kind of modern endeavor to probe the mind by scientific methods. Thus, Adler's school must submit to being labeled psychoanalytic, despite the fact that Adler's viewpoint and method are apparently in irreconcilable opposition to those of Freud. Because of this contrast, Adler himself does not call his teaching psychoanalysis, but individual psychology, while I prefer to call my own approach analytical psychology. I wish the term to stand for a general conception embracing both psychoanalysis and individual psychology, as well as other efforts in this field. Since the mind is common to mankind, it may seem to the layman that there can only be one psychology, and he may therefore suppose the divergences between the schools to be either subjective quibbling or else a commonplace disguise for the efforts of mediocrities who seek to exalt themselves upon a throne. I could easily lengthen the list of psychologies by mentioning other systems that are not to be included under the head of analytical psychology. There are, in fact, many methods, standpoints, views, and convictions, which are all at war with one another. The main reason for this being that, since they fail to be mutually comprehensible, none of them can grant the validity of any other. The many-sidedness and variety of psychological opinions in our time is nothing less than astonishing, and it is confusing for the layman that no general survey of them can be made. When we find the most diverse remedies prescribed in a textbook of pathology for a given disease, we may confidently assume that none of these remedies is particularly efficacious. So, when many different ways of approaching the psyche are recommended, we may rest assured that none of them leads with absolute certainty to the goal, least of all those advocated in a fanatical way. The very number of present-day psychologies amounts to a confession of perplexity. The difficulty of gaining access to the mind is gradually borne upon us, and the mind itself is seen to be, to use Nietzsche's expression, a horned problem. It is small wonder, therefore, that efforts to attack this elusive riddle are multiplied, first from one side and then from another. The variety of contradictory standpoints and opinions, of which we have spoken, is the inevitable result. The reader will doubtless agree that in discussing psychoanalysis, we should not limit ourselves to its narrower definition, but deal in general with the results and failures of the various contemporary endeavors to solve the problem of the psyche. Endeavors which we have agreed shall all be embraced in the concept of analytical psychology. And moreover, why is there suddenly so much interest in the human psyche as something to be experienced? This has not been the case for thousands of years. I wish merely to raise this apparently irrelevant question and will not try to answer it. It is in reality not irrelevant because this interest underlies all such modern movements as theosophy, occultism, astrology, and so forth. All that is embraced today in the layman's idea of psychoanalysis originated in medical practice, and consequently, most of it is medical psychology. It bears the unmistakable imprint of the physician's consulting room, a fact which is evident not only in its terminology, but also in its framework of theory. We constantly come upon postulates which the physician has taken over from natural science, and in particular from biology. This fact has largely contributed to the hostility between modern psychology and the academic fields of philosophy, history, and classical learning. Modern psychology is empirical and close to nature, while these studies are grounded in the intellect. The distance between nature and mind, difficult to bridge at best, is increased by a medical and biological nomenclature which sometimes appears of practical utility, but more often severely taxes our goodwill. In view of the confusion of concepts that exists, I have felt it necessary to indulge in the foregoing general remarks. I should like now to turn to the task in hand and consider the actual achievements of analytical psychology. Since the various endeavors embraced by this term are so heterogeneous, it is extremely difficult to take up a generally inclusive standpoint. If, then, with regard to the aims and results of these endeavors, I try to distinguish certain classes, or rather stages, I do it with some reservation. I regard it as a merely provisional arrangement, and grant that it may seem as arbitrary as a surveyor's triangulation of a country. Be that as it may, I venture to arrange the sum total of findings under the four heads of confession, explanation, education, and transformation. I shall now proceed to discuss the meaning of these somewhat unusual terms. The first beginnings of all analytical treatment are to be found in its prototype, the confessional. Since, however, the two practices have no direct causal connection, but rather grow from a common psychic root, it is difficult for an outsider to see at once the relation between the groundwork of psychoanalysis and the religious institution of the confessional. As soon as man was capable of conceiving the idea of sin, he had recourse to psychic concealment, or, to put it in the analytical language, repressions arose. Anything that is concealed is a secret. The maintenance of secrets acts like a psychic poison which alienates their possessor from the community. In small doses, this poison may actually be a priceless remedy, even an essential preliminary to the differentiation of the individual. This is so much the case that, even on a primitive level, man has felt an irresistible need to invent secrets. Their possession saves him from dissolving in the unconsciousness of mere community life, and thus from a fatal psychic injury. As is well known, the many ancient mystery cults with their secret rituals served this instinct for differentiation. Even the Christian sacraments were looked upon as mysteries in the early church and, as in the case of baptism, were celebrated in private apartments and only referred to under a veil of allegory. However beneficial a secret shared with several persons may be, a merely private secret has a destructive effect. It resembles a burden of guilt which cuts off the unfortunate possessor from communion with his fellow beings. Yet if we are conscious of what we conceal, the harm done is decidedly less than if we do not know what we are repressing, or even that we have repressions at all. In the latter case, we not merely keep a content consciously private, but we conceal it even from ourselves. It then splits off from consciousness as an independent complex to lead a separate existence in the unconscious, where it can be neither corrected nor interfered with by the conscious mind. The complex is thus an autonomous portion of the psyche, which, as experience has shown, develops a peculiar fantasy life of its own. What we call fantasy is simply spontaneous psychic activity, and it wells up whenever the repressive action of the conscious mind relaxes or ceases altogether, as in sleep. In sleep, this activity shows itself in the form of dreams, and we continue to dream in waking life beneath the threshold of consciousness, especially when this activity is conditioned by a repressed or otherwise unconscious complex. It should be said in passing that unconscious contents are by no means exclusively such as were once conscious and, by being repressed, have later grown into unconscious complexes. Quite otherwise, the unconscious has contents peculiar to itself which, slowly growing upward from the depths, at last come into consciousness. We should therefore in no wise picture the unconscious psyche to ourselves as a mere receptacle for contents discarded by the conscious mind. All psychic contents which either approach the threshold of consciousness from below or have sunk only slightly beneath it have an effect upon our conscious activities. Since the content itself is not conscious, these effects are necessarily indirect. Most of our lapses of the tongue, of the pen, of memory, and the like are traceable to these disturbances, as are likewise all neurotic symptoms. These are nearly always of psychic origin, the exceptions being shock effects from shell explosions and other causes. The mildest forms of neurosis are the lapses already referred to, blunders of speech, the sudden forgetting of names and dates, unexpected clumsiness leading to injuries or accidents, misunderstandings of personal motives or of what we have heard or read, and so-called hallucinations of memory, which cause us to suppose erroneously that we have said or done this or that. In all these cases, a thorough investigation can show the existence of a content which, in an indirect and unconscious way, has distorted the conscious performance. In general, therefore, an unconscious secret is more harmful than one that is conscious. I have seen many patients in difficult situations of life which might have driven weaker natures to suicide. These patients had at times a tendency toward suicide, but on account of their inherent reasonableness, would not allow the suicidal urge to come into consciousness. But it remained active in the unconscious and brought about all kinds of dangerous accidents, as for instance an attack of faintness, or hesitation in front of an advancing motor car, the swallowing of corrosive sublimate in the belief that it was a cough mixture, a sudden zest for dangerous acrobatics, and so forth. When it was possible to make the suicidal leaning conscious, common sense could helpfully intervene. The patients could then recognize and avoid those situations that tempted them to self-destruction. As we have seen, every personal secret has the effect of a sin or of guilt, whether or not it is, from the standpoint of popular morality, a wrongful secret. Now another form of concealment is the act of withholding, it being usually emotions that are withheld. As in the case of secrets, so here also we must make a reservation. Self-restraint is healthful and beneficial. It is even a virtue. This is why we find self-discipline to have been one of man's earliest moral attainments. Among primitive peoples, it has its place in the initiation ceremonies, chiefly in the forms of ascetic continence and the stoical endurance of pain and fear. Self-restraint, however, is here practiced within the secret society as something undertaken in company with others. But if self-restraint is only a private matter, and perhaps devoid of any religious aspect, then it may be as harmful as the personal secret. From this kind of self-restraint come our well-known ugly moods and the irritability of the over-virtuous. The emotion withheld is also something we conceal, something which we can hide even from ourselves, an art in which men particularly excel, while women, with very few exceptions, are by nature averse to doing such violence to their emotions. When emotion is withheld, it tends to isolate and disturb us quite as much as an unconscious secret, and is equally guilt-laden. Just as nature bears us ill will, as it were, if we possess a secret to which mankind has not attained, so also she has a grudge against us if we withhold our emotions from our fellow men. Nature decidedly abhors a vacuum in this respect. In the long run, nothing is more unbearable than a tepid harmony in personal relations brought about by withholding emotion. The repressed emotions are often a kind we wish to keep secret. But more often, there is no secret worthy of the name. There are merely quite avowable emotions which, from being withheld at some important juncture, have become unconscious. It is probable that one form of neurosis is conditioned by the predominance of secrets, and another by the predominance of restrained emotions. At any rate, the hysterical subject, who is very free with his emotions, is most often the possessor of a secret, while the hardened psychasthenic suffers from inability to digest his emotions. To cherish secrets and to restrain emotions are psychic misdemeanors, for which nature finally visits us with sickness, that is, when we do these things in private. But when they are done in communion with others, they satisfy nature and may even count as useful virtues. It is only restraint practiced in and for oneself that is unwholesome. It is as if man had an inalienable right to behold all that is dark, imperfect, stupid, and guilty in his fellow beings, for such, of course, are the things that we keep private to protect ourselves. It seems to be a sin in the eyes of nature to hide our insufficiency, just as much as to live entirely on our inferior side. There appears to be a conscience in mankind which severely punishes the man who does not somehow and at some time, at whatever cost to his pride, cease to defend and assert himself, and instead confess himself fallible and human. Until he can do this, an impenetrable wall shuts him out from the living experience of feeling himself a man among men. Here we find a key to the great significance of true, unstereotyped confession, a significance known in all the initiation and mystery cults of the ancient world, and is shown by a saying from the Greek mysteries, "Give up what thou hast, and then thou wilt receive." We may well take this saying as a motto for the first stage in psychotherapeutic treatment. It is a fact that the beginnings of psychoanalysis were fundamentally nothing else than the scientific rediscovery of an ancient truth. Even the name catharsis, or cleansing, which was given to the earliest method of treatment, comes from the Greek initiation rites. The early method of catharsis consisted in putting the patient, with or without hypnotic aid, in touch with the hinterland of his mind, that is to say, into that state which the Eastern yoga systems describe as meditation or contemplation. In contrast to the meditation found in yoga practice, the psychoanalytic aim is to observe the shadowy presentations, whether in the form of images or feelings, that are spontaneously evolved in the unconscious psyche and appear without his bidding to the man who looks within. In this way, we find once more things that we have repressed or forgotten. Painful though it may be, this in itself is a gain. For what is inferior or even worthless belongs to me as my shadow and gives me substance and mass. How can I be substantial if I fail to cast a shadow? I must have a dark side also if I am to be whole. And inasmuch as I become conscious of my shadow, I also remember that I am a human being like any other. In any case, when I keep it to myself, this rediscovery of that which makes me whole restores the condition which preceded the neurosis or the splitting off of the complex. In keeping the matter private, I have only attained a partial cure, for I still continue in my state of isolation. It is only with the help of confession that I am able to throw myself into the arms of humanity, freed at last from the burden of moral exile. The goal of treatment by catharsis is full confession, no merely intellectual acknowledgement of the facts, but their confirmation by the heart and the actual release of the suppressed emotions. As can easily be imagined, such confessions have a great effect with simple people, and their curative results are often astonishing. Yet I do not wish to point to the fact that some patients are cured as being the main achievement of psychotherapy at this level. What I wish to call attention to is the systematic emphasis given to the significance of confession. It is this which strikes home to all of us, for we are all in some way or other kept asunder by our secrets. And instead of seeking through confession to bridge the abysses that separate us from one another, we choose the easy byway of deceptive opinions and illusions. In saying this, however, I am far from wishing to enunciate a general maxim. It would be hard to go too far in condemning the bad taste of a common, mutual confession of sins. The fact established by psychology is simply this: we are dealing here with a delicate matter. We cannot handle it directly or by itself, for it offers us a problem with unusually pointed horns. A consideration of the next stage, that of explanation, will make this clear. It is evident enough that the new psychology would have remained at the stage of confession had catharsis proved itself a panacea. First and foremost, it is not always possible to bring certain patients close enough to the unconscious to enable them to perceive the shadows. Indeed, there are many patients, for the most part complicated, highly conscious persons, who are so firmly anchored in consciousness that nothing can pry them loose. They often develop the most violent resistances whenever an attempt is made to push consciousness aside. They wish to talk with the physician of things about which they are fully conscious, to make their difficulties intelligible and to discuss them. They already have quite enough to confess, they say. They do not have to turn to the unconscious for that. For such patients, a complete technique for effecting the approach to the unconscious is needed. This is one fact which at the outset seriously restricts us in applying the method of catharsis. The other limitation is revealed later on, and its discussion at once leads us to the problems of the second stage, the stage of explanation. Let us suppose that in a given case, the confession demanded by the method of catharsis has taken place, that the neurosis has disappeared, or that the symptoms, at least, have vanished. The patient could now be dismissed as cured if it depended on the physician alone, but he, or especially she, cannot get away. The patient seems bound to the physician by the act of confession. If this apparently meaningless attachment is forcibly severed, there is a bad relapse. It is both curious and significant that there are cases where no attachment develops. The patient goes away apparently cured. But he is now so fascinated by the hinterland of his own mind that he continues to practice catharsis by himself at the expense of his adaptation to life. He is bound to the unconscious, to himself, not to the physician. He has obviously shared the experience of Theseus and his comrade Pirithous in their descent to Hades to bring back the goddess of the underworld. Tiring on the way, they sat down to rest for a while, only to find out they had grown to the rocks and could not rise. These curious and unexpected occurrences must be explained to the patients, while the first-mentioned cases, who were inaccessible to catharsis, must also be handled by the method of explanation. In spite of the fact that the two classes of patients are apparently quite different, it is at the same point that explanation is called for, that is, where the problem of fixation arises, as was recognized by Freud. This fixation is evident enough in patients who have undergone catharsis, and it is especially clear in those who remain attached to the physician. Something similar has already been observed as an unpleasant result of hypnotic treatment, but the inner mechanism of such a tie was not understood. It now appears that the questionable bond essentially corresponds to the relation between father and child. The patient falls into a sort of childish dependence from which he cannot protect himself even by reason and insight. The fixation is at times astonishingly strong. So much so that one suspects it of being fed by forces quite out of the common. But since the process of transference is an unconscious one, the patient is unable to give any information about it. We are obviously dealing with a new symptom, a neurotic formation directly induced by the treatment. The question therefore arises, how is this new difficulty to be met? The unmistakable outward sign of the situation is that the memory image of the father, with its accent of feeling, is transferred to the physician. Inasmuch as the latter willy-nilly appears in the role of father, the patient slips into a childish relation. He has not, of course, been made childish by this relation. There was always something childish about him, but it was suppressed. Now it comes to the surface, and, the long-lost father being found again, it tries to reproduce the family situation of childhood. Freud gave to this symptom the appropriate name of transference. A certain dependence upon the physician, who has helped you, is of course normal and understandable enough. What is abnormal and unexpected is the unusual obstinacy of the transference and its inaccessibility to conscious correction. It is one of Freud's outstanding achievements to have explained the nature of this tie, at least in the light of man's personal history, and so to have cleared the way for an important advance in psychological knowledge. It has today been put beyond a doubt that it is caused by unconscious fantasies. These fantasies have in the main what we may call an incestuous character, and this seems adequately to explain the fact that they remain unconscious and cannot be expected to turn up in the most thorough confession. Although Freud always speaks of incest fantasies as if they were repressed, further experience shows us that in many cases they have never been conscious, or have been sensed only in the vaguest way, for which reason they could not be intentionally repressed. More recent research seems to show that the incest fantasies are usually unconscious and so remain till they are dragged to light in analytical treatment. By this I do not mean that pulling them up from the unconscious is an interference with nature, which we should avoid. I merely wish to suggest that the procedure is almost as drastic as a surgical operation. But it is wholly unavoidable in that the analytical procedure induces a transference which is abnormal, and can only be dealt with by reaching the incest fantasies. While the method of catharsis restores to the ego such contents as are accessible to consciousness and are normally included in it, the process of clearing up the transference brings to light contents which, because of their nature, were almost inaccessible to consciousness. This is the main difference between the stage of confession and the stage of explanation. We have discussed above two sets of cases, those of such patients as do not lend themselves to the method of catharsis, and those for whom it gives results. We have, moreover, just treated of those whose fixation takes the form of a transference. Besides these, there are those people we have also mentioned who develop no attachment to the physician, but rather one to their own unconscious, in which they become entangled, as in a web. In these cases, the parental image is not transferred to a human object. It is seen as a fantasy, and yet it exerts the same power of attraction and produces the same attachment as does the transference. The patients who cannot give themselves without reserve to treatment by catharsis can be understood in the light of Freudian research. We can see that, even before coming to the doctor, they had identified themselves with their parents and derive from this identification that force of authority, that independence and critical power which enables them to offer a successful resistance to the treatment. These are chiefly cultivated and differentiated persons. While others become the helpless victims of the unconscious parental image, these draw strength from it by unconsciously identifying themselves with their parents. In the matter of the transference, we can get nowhere with the help of confession. It was this which drove Freud to a fundamental renovation of Breuer's original technique of catharsis and to what he himself called the interpretive method. This further step necessarily follows, for the relationship produced by the transference especially requires explanation. The layman can hardly appreciate the importance of this, but the doctor who finds himself suddenly entangled in a web of incomprehensible and fantastic notions sees it all too clearly. He must interpret the transference to the patient, that is, explain to him what it is that he projects upon his doctor. Since the patient himself does not know what it is, the physician is forced to subject what scraps of fantasy he can obtain from the patient to analytical interpretation. It is first and foremost our dreams which furnish this important material. While investigating the suppression of wishes, which are incompatible with our conscious standpoint, Freud studied dreams in search of these wishes, and in the process discovered the incestuous contents of which I have spoken. These were, of course, not the only materials revealed by the investigation. He discovered all the filth of which human nature is capable. And it is notorious that it would require a lifetime to make even a rough inventory of it. The end product of the Freudian method of explanation is a detailed elaboration of man's shadow side, such as had never been carried out before. It is the most effective antidote imaginable to all idealistic illusions about the nature of man, and it is therefore no wonder that there arose on all sides the most violent opposition to Freud and his school. We could expect nothing else of those who believe in illusions on principle, but I maintain that there are not a few among the opponents of the method of explanation who have no illusions as to man's shadow side, and who yet object to a biased portrayal of man from the shadow side alone. After all, the essential thing is not the shadow, but the body which casts it. Freud's method of interpretation rests upon reductive explanations, which unfailingly lead backward and downward, and it has a destructive effect if it is used in an exaggerated and one-sided way. Nevertheless, psychology has profited greatly from Freud's pioneer work. It has learned that human nature has also a black side, and that not man alone possesses this side, but his works, his institutions, and his convictions as well. Even our purest and holiest beliefs can be traced to the crudest origins. This way of looking at things even has its justification, for the beginning of all living organisms is simple and lowly. We build our houses from the foundation up. No thoughtful person will deny that Solomon Renoc's explanation of the Last Supper in terms of primitive totemism is fraught with meaning. Nor will he object to the incest theme being pointed out in the myths of the Greek divinities. It is painful, there is no denying it, to interpret radiant things from the shadow side, and thus in a measure reduce them to their origins in dreary filth. But it seems to me to be an imperfection in things of beauty, and a weakness in man, if an explanation from the shadow side has a destructive effect. The horror which we feel for Freudian interpretations is entirely due to our own barbaric or childish naivete, which believes that there can be heights without corresponding depths, and which blinds us to the really final truth that, when carried to extremes, opposites meet. Our mistake would lie in supposing that what is radiant no longer exists because it has been explained from the shadow side. This is a regrettable error into which Freud himself has fallen. Yet the shadow belongs to the light, as the evil belongs to the good, and vice versa. Therefore, I cannot regret the shock that was felt at the exposure of our Occidental illusions and pettiness. On the contrary, I welcome this exposure and attach to it an almost incalculable significance. It is one of those swings of the pendulum which, as history has so often shown, set matters right again. It forces us to accept a present-day philosophical relativism, such as has been formulated by Einstein for mathematical physics, and which is fundamentally a truth of the Far East, whose ultimate effects upon us we cannot foresee. Nothing influences our conduct less than do intellectual ideas, but when an idea is the expression of psychic experience which bears fruit in regions as far separated and as free from historical relation as East and West, then we must look into the matter closely. For such ideas represent forces that are beyond logical justification and moral sanction. They are always stronger than man and his brain. Man believes indeed that he molds these ideas, but in reality they mold him and make him their unwitting mouthpiece. To return again to the problem of fixation, I should like now to deal with the effects of the process of explanation. The patient becomes aware of the unsoundness of his position with respect to the doctor when his transference has been traced back to its dark origins. He cannot avoid seeing how inappropriate and childish his claims are. If he has been inflated by a sense of authority, he will exchange his elevated position for one that is more modest and will accept an insecurity which may prove very wholesome. If he has not yet renounced his infantile claims upon the doctor, he will now recognize the inescapable truth that to make claims on others is a childish self-indulgence which must be replaced by a greater sense of his own responsibility. The man of insight will draw his own moral conclusions. Convinced of his own deficiencies, he will use this knowledge as a means of protection. He will plunge into the struggle for existence and consume in progressive work and experience that force of longing which has caused him to cling obstinately to a child's paradise, or at least to look back at it over his shoulder. A normal adaptation and patience with his own shortcomings will become his guiding moral principles, and he will try to free himself from sentimentality and illusion. The inevitable result will be that he turns away from the unconscious as from a source of weakness and temptation, the field of moral and social defeat. The problem which now faces the patient is that of being educated as a social being. And with this, we come to the third stage. Mere insight into themselves is sufficient for morally sensitive persons who have enough driving force to carry them forward. For those with little imagination for moral values, however, it does not suffice. Without the spur of external necessity, self-knowledge is ineffective for them even when they are deeply convinced, to say nothing of those who have been struck by the analyst's interpretation and yet doubt it after all. These last are mentally disciplined people who grasp the truth of a reductive explanation, but cannot accept it when it merely invalidates their hopes and ideals. In these cases also, mere insight is insufficient. It is a weakness of the method of explanation that it succeeds only with sensitive persons who can draw independent moral conclusions from their understanding of themselves. It is true that we can get further with explanation than with uninterpreted confession alone, for it at least trains the mind and therefore may awaken sleeping powers which can intervene in a helpful way. But the fact remains that the most thorough explanation leaves the patient in many cases an intelligent but still incapable child. The trouble is that Freudian explanation in terms of pleasure and its satisfaction are one-sided and therefore insufficient, especially when applied to the latter stages of development. This viewpoint will not account for everybody. For even if everyone possesses this side, it is not always the most important. A hungry artist prefers bread to a beautiful painting, and a man in love prefers a woman to his public career. Yet the painting may be of the greatest importance to the one and public office to the other. On the average, those who easily achieve social adaptation and social position are better accounted for by the pleasure principle than are the unadapted, whose social shortcomings leave them with a craving for power and importance. The older brother who follows in the footsteps of his father and attains a commanding position may be tortured by his desires. But the younger brother who feels repressed and overshadowed by the other two may be goaded by ambition or the craving for respect. He may even yield so completely to this passion that nothing else is vital to him. At this point, we become aware that Freud's explanation of things falls short, and it is precisely here that his former pupil, Adler, comes forward to fill the gap. Adler has shown convincingly that many cases of neurosis can be more satisfactorily explained on the ground of an urge to power than by the pleasure principle. His interpretation, therefore, is designed to show the patient that he arranges his symptoms and exploits his neurosis to attain a fictitious importance, that even his transference and his other fixations serve his will to power and thus represent a masculine protest against a fancied subjection. Adler obviously has his eye on repressed and socially unsuccessful people whose one passion is for self-assertion. These people are neurotic because they always imagine themselves oppressed and tilt at the windmills of their own fancies, thus putting the goal they most desire quite out of reach. In essentials, Adler's method begins at the second stage. He explains the symptoms in the sense just indicated, and to this extent appeals to the patient's understanding. Yet it is characteristic of Adler that he does not expect too much of understanding, but taking a further step, has clearly recognized the need for social education. While Freud is an investigator and interpreter, Adler is chiefly an educator. In refusing to leave the patient in a childish condition, helpless for all his valuable understanding, and in trying by every device of education to make him a normally adapted person, Adler modifies Freud's procedure. He does all this apparently in the conviction that social adaptation and normalization are indispensable, that they are even the most desirable goals and the most suitable fulfillment for a human being. The widespread social influence of Adler's school is a consequence of this outlook, as also its neglect of the unconscious, which on occasions, it seems, amounts to complete denial. This is probably a swing of the pendulum, an inevitable reaction to Freud's emphasis on the unconscious, which corresponds to the natural aversion for it, which we have noted in patients who are struggling for adaptation and health. For if the unconscious is held to be a mere receptacle for all the evil shadow things in human nature, including even primeval slime deposits, we really do not see why we should still linger on the edge of this swamp into which we once fell. The investigator may see in the mud puddle a world full of wonders, but to the ordinary man, it is something upon which he prefers to turn his back, just as early Buddhism recognized no gods because it had to free itself from an inheritance of nearly 2 million gods, so must psychology, if it is to develop further, renounce so essentially negative an approach to the unconscious as Freud's. The Adlerian school, with its educational intent, begins at the very point where Freud leaves off, and thus helps the patient who has learned to see into himself to find the way to normal life. It is obviously not enough for him to know how and why he fell ill, for to understand the causes of an evil does very little towards curing it. We must never forget that the crooked paths of a neurosis lead to as many obstinate habits, and that, despite any amount of understanding, these do not disappear until they are replaced by other habits. But habits are only won by exercise, and appropriate education is the sole means to this end. The patient must be, as it were, prodded into other paths, and this always requires an educating will. We can therefore see why it is that Adler's approach has found favor chiefly with clergymen and teachers, while Freud's school has its advocates among physicians and intellectuals, who one and all are bad nurses and educators. Every stage in our psychic development has something peculiarly final about it. When we have experienced catharsis with its wholesale confession, we feel that we have reached our goal at last. All has come out. All is known. Every anxiety has been lived through and every tear shed. Now things will go as they ought. After the work of explanation, we are equally persuaded that we now know how the neurosis arose. The earliest memories have been unearthed, the deepest roots dug up. The transference was nothing but the wish-fulfilling fantasy of a child's paradise or a regression to the old family situation. The way to a normally disillusioned life is now open. But then comes the period of education, which makes us realize that no confession and no amount of explaining will make the ill-formed tree grow straight, but that it must be trained with the gardener's art upon the trellis before normal adaptation can be attained. The curious sense of finality which attends every stage of development accounts for the fact that there are people using catharsis today who have apparently never heard of dream interpretation, Freudians who do not understand a word of Adler, and Adlerians who do not wish to hear any mention of the unconscious. Each is deceived by the sense of finality peculiar to the stage of development at which he stands. And this gives rise to that confusion of opinions and views which makes it so hard for us to find our bearings. But what causes this sense of finality which evokes such bigoted obstinacy in all directions? I can only explain it to myself on the ground that each stage of development is summed up in a basic truth, and that therefore cases frequently recur which demonstrate this truth in a striking way. Our world is so exceedingly rich in delusions that a truth is priceless, and no one will let it slip because of a few exceptions with which it cannot be brought into accord. Whoever doubts this truth is of course looked upon as a faithless reprobate, while a note of fanaticism and intolerance creeps into the discussion on all sides. And yet, each of us can carry the torch of knowledge but a part of the way, until another takes it from him. Could we but accept this in an impersonal way? Could we but grasp the fact that we are not the personal creators of our truths, but only their exponents, who thus make articulate the psychic needs of our day? Then much of the poison and bitterness might be spared, and we should be able to perceive the profound and superpersonal continuity of the human mind. We generally take too little account of the fact that the doctor who uses catharsis as a mode of treatment is something more than the embodiment of an abstract idea which automatically produces nothing but catharsis. He is also a man. His thinking, to be sure, may be limited to his special field, but in his behavior he exerts the influence of a complete human being. Without being clearly conscious of it or giving it a name, he unwittingly does a great deal in the way of explanation and education. And other analysts do as much in the way of catharsis without raising it to the level of a principle. The three stages of analytical psychology so far dealt with are by no means of such a nature that the last can replace the first or the second. All three quite properly coexist and are salient aspects of one and the same problem. They no more invalidate each other than do confession and absolution. And the same is true of the fourth, the stage of transformation. It must not claim to be the finally achieved and only valid truth. Its part is to make up a deficit left by the previous stages. It comes to meet an additional and still unsatisfied need. In order to make clear what this fourth stage has in view, and to throw some light on the curious term transformation, we must first take account of those psychic needs of man which were not given a place in the other stages. In other words, we must ascertain what could seem more desirable or lead further than the claim to be a normally adapted social being. Nothing is more useful or fitting than to be a normal human being, but the very notion of a normal human being suggests a restriction to the average, as does also the concept of adaptation. It is only a man who, as things stand, already finds it difficult to come to terms with the everyday world, who can see in this restriction a desirable improvement, a man, let us say, whose neurosis unfits him for normal life. To be normal is a splendid ideal for the unsuccessful, for all those who have not yet found an adaptation. But for people who have far more ability than the average, for whom it was never hard to gain successes and to accomplish their share of the world's work, for them, restriction to the normal signifies the bed of Procrustes, unbearable boredom, infernal sterility, and hopelessness. As a consequence, there are many people who become neurotic because they are only normal, as there are people who are neurotic because they cannot become normal. For the former, the very thought that you want to educate them to normality is a nightmare. Their deepest need is really to be able to lead abnormal lives. A man can hope for satisfaction and fulfillment only in what he does not yet possess. He cannot find pleasure in something of which he has already had too much. To be a socially adapted being has no charms for one to whom to be so is mere child's play. Always to do what is right becomes a bore for the man who knows how, whereas the eternal bungler cherishes the secret longing to be right for once in some distant future. The needs and necessities of individuals vary. What sets one free is for another a prison, as for instance normality and adaptation. Although it is a biological dictum that man is a herd animal and is only healthy when he lives as a social being, yet the first case we observe may seem to upset this statement and to prove that man is only healthy when leading an abnormal and unsocial life. It is a terrible misfortune that practical psychology can offer no generally valid recipes and norms. There are only individual cases whose needs and demands are totally different. So different that we really cannot foresee what course a given case will follow. It is therefore wise of the physician to renounce all premature assumptions. This does not mean that he should throw all his assumptions overboard, but that he should regard them in any given case as hypothetical. Yet it is not the doctor's whole task to instruct or convince his patient. He must rather show him how the doctor reacts to his particular case. For twist and turn the matter as we may, the relation between physician and patient remains personal within the frame of the impersonal, professional treatment. We cannot by any device bring it about that the treatment is not the outcome of a mutual influence in which the whole being of the patient as well as that of the doctor plays its part. Two primary factors come together in the treatment, that is, two persons, neither of whom is a fixed and determinable magnitude. Their fields of consciousness may be quite clearly defined, but they bring with them besides an indefinitely extended sphere of unconsciousness. For this reason, the personalities of the doctor and patient have often more to do with the outcome of the treatment than what the doctor says or thinks, although we must not undervalue this latter factor as a disturbing or healing one. The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed. We should expect the doctor to have an influence on the patient in every effective psychic treatment. But this influence can only take place when he too is affected by the patient. You can exert no influence if you are not susceptible to influence. It is futile for the doctor to shield himself from the influence of the patient and to surround himself with a smokescreen of fatherly and professional authority. If he does so, he merely forbids himself the use of a highly important organ of information, and the patient influences him unconsciously nonetheless. The unconscious changes in the doctor which the patient thus brings about are well known to many psychotherapists. They are disturbances, or even injuries, peculiar to the profession, which illustrate in a striking way the patient's almost chemical influence. One of the best known of them is the countertransference which the transference evokes. But the effects are often more subtle, and their nature is best conveyed by the old idea of the demon of sickness. According to this, a sufferer transmits his disease to a healthy person whose powers subdue the demon, but not without a negative influence upon the well-being of the healer. In the relation between doctor and patient, we meet the imponderable factors which bring about a mutual transformation. In this exchange, the more stable and the stronger personality will decide the final issue. But I have seen many cases in which the patient has proved stronger than the doctor, in defiance of all theory and the doctor's intention. And where this has happened, it has most often, though not always, been to the disadvantage of the doctor. The fact of mutual influence and all that goes with it underlies the stage of transformation. More than a quarter of a century of wide practical experience was needed for the clear recognition of these manifestations. Freud himself has admitted their importance and has therefore seconded my demand that the analyst himself be analyzed. But what is the wider meaning of this demand? It means nothing less than that the doctor is just as much in analysis as the patient. He is as much a part of the psychic process of the treatment as is the patient, and is equally exposed to the transforming influences. Indeed, if the doctor is more or less inaccessible to this influence, he is correspondingly robbed of his influence over the patient. If he is influenced only unconsciously, he shows a defect of consciousness which prevents him from seeing the patient correctly. In both cases, the result of the treatment is compromised. The physician, then, is called upon himself to face that task which he wishes the patient to face. If it is a question of becoming socially adapted, he himself must become so, or, in the reverse case, appropriately non-adapted. There are, of course, a thousand different aspects of this requirement in therapy, according to the situation in a given case. One doctor believes in overcoming infantilism, and therefore he must overcome his own infantilism. Another believes in the abreaction of all emotion, and so he must have abreacted all his own emotions. A third believes in complete consciousness, so that he must have reached an advanced state of consciousness himself. At all events, the doctor must consistently try to meet his own therapeutic demands if he wishes to assure himself of a proper influence on his patient. All these guiding principles in therapy confront the doctor with important ethical duties, which can be summed up in the single rule: be the man through whom you wish to influence others. Mere talk has always been considered hollow, and there is no trick, however cunning, by which one can evade this simple rule for long. The fact of being convinced, and not the subject matter of conviction, it is this which has always carried weight. The fourth stage of analytical psychology, then, demands not only the transformation of the patient, but also the counter-application to himself by the doctor of the system which he prescribes in any given case. And in dealing with himself, the doctor must display as much relentlessness, consistency, and perseverance as in dealing with his patients. To work upon himself with an equal concentration is truly no small achievement, for he brings to bear all the attentiveness and critical judgment he can summon in showing his patients their mistaken paths, their false conclusions, and infantile subterfuges. No one pays the doctor for his introspective efforts, and moreover, we are generally not interested enough in ourselves. Again, we so commonly undervalue the deeper aspects of the human psyche that we hold self-examination or preoccupation with ourselves to be almost morbid. We evidently suspect ourselves of harboring rather unwholesome things all too reminiscent of a sick room. The physician must overcome these resistances in himself, for who can educate others while himself uneducated? Who can enlighten his fellows while still in the dark about himself, and who can purify if he is himself unclean? The step from educating others to self-education is demanded of the doctor in the stage of transformation. It is the corollary of the demand that the patient transform himself and thus complete the earlier stages of the treatment. This challenge to the doctor to transform himself in order to effect a change in the patient meets with scant popular approval for three reasons. First of all, it seems unpractical. Secondly, there is a prejudice against being occupied with ourselves. And thirdly, it is sometimes very painful to make ourselves live up to everything that we expect of the patient. This last is the strongest reason for the unpopularity of the demand that the doctor examine himself. For if he conscientiously doctors himself, he will soon discover things in his nature which are completely opposed to normalization, or which continue to haunt him in the most disturbing way in spite of exhaustive explanations and thorough abreaction. What will he do about these things? He always knows what the patient should do about them. It is his professional duty to do so. But what will he, in all sincerity, do about them when they involve himself or perhaps those who stand nearest to him? If he examines himself, he will discover some inferior side which brings him dangerously near to his patient and perhaps even blights his authority. How will he handle this tormenting discovery? This somewhat neurotic question will touch him on the quick, no matter how normal he deems himself to be. He will also discover that the ultimate questions which oppress him, as well as his patients, cannot be solved by any amount of treatment. He will let them see that to expect solutions from others is a way of remaining childish, and he will see for himself that, if no solutions can be found, these questions must only be repressed again. I will not discuss further the matter of self-examination and the many problems it raises, because the great obscurity which still surrounds our study of the psyche allows of little interest in them. I would rather emphasize what has already been said, that the newest developments of analytical psychology confront us with the imponderable elements of human personality, that we have learned to place in the foreground the personality of the doctor himself as a curative or harmful factor, and that we have begun to demand his own transformation, the self-education of the educator. Everything that happened to the patient must now happen to the doctor, and he must pass through the stages of confession, explanation, and education, so that his personality will not react unfavorably on the patient. The physician may no longer slip out of his own difficulties by treating the difficulties of others. He will remember that a man who suffers from a running abscess is not fit to perform a surgical operation. Just as the discovery of the unconscious shadow side once forced the school of Freud to deal even with questions of religion, so the latest advance of analytical psychology makes an unavoidable problem of the doctor's ethical attitude. The self-criticism and self-examination demanded of him radically alter our view of the human psyche. This cannot be grasped from the standpoint of natural science. It is not only the sufferer, but the physician as well. Not only the object, but also the subject. Not only a function of the brain, but the sine qua non of consciousness itself. What was formerly a method of medical treatment now becomes a method of self-education, and therewith the horizon of our modern psychology is immeasurably widened. The medical diploma is no longer the crucial thing, but human quality instead. This is a significant step. All the implements of psychotherapy developed in clinical practice, refined and systematized, are now put at our service and can be used for our self-education and self-perfectioning. Analytical psychology is no longer bound to the consulting room of the doctor. Its chains have been severed. We might say that it transcends itself and now advances to fill that void which hitherto has marked the psychic insufficiency of Western culture as compared with that of the East. We Occidentals had learned to tame and subject the psyche, but we knew nothing about its methodical development and its functions. Our civilization is still young, and we therefore required all the devices of the animal tamer to make the defiant barbarian and the savage in us, in some measure, tractable. But when we reach a higher cultural level, we must forego compulsion and turn to self-development. For this, we must have knowledge of a way or a method. And so far, we have known of none. It seems to me that the findings and experiences of analytical psychology can at least provide a foundation. For as soon as psychotherapy requires the self-perfecting of the doctor, it is freed from its clinical origins and ceases to be a mere method for treating the sick. It is now a service to the healthy as well, or at least to those who have a right to psychic health, and whose illness is at most the suffering that tortures us all. For this reason, we may hope to see analytical psychology become of general use, more so even than the methods which constitute its preliminary stages and which severally carry a general truth. But between the realization of this hope and the actual present, there lies an abyss over which no bridge is to be found. We have yet to build it stone by stone.